It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the spending review and what it means for higher education, a new report from the Post-18 Project on aligning institutional priorities with industrial strategy, plus there's been an interesting survey on the student academic experience. It's all coming up.
Good decision was made to soften the approach to withdrawing winter fuel allowances and looking after our pensioners. There were no similar offers to students, and so they will really be feeling some of the pain of this themselves.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and to start, I just need to give a quick reminder that the early bird prices for this year's Festival of Higher Education expire next week, so do get in quick on that if you want to come along and save your institution a bit of cash as well. Now, joining me to review this week's HE policy, we have three fantastic guests. As always, in Bristol, it's Stephanie Harris, Director of Policy at Universities UK. Steph, your heart of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is going to be professional, I'm afraid, and it's going to be the spending review. As someone who works in policy, it's kind of great to see the kind of starting gun fired on the next 3 years of government spending and policy.
Yep, and in Yorkshire, it's Ben Villiamy, Executive Director at the Association of Heads of University Administration. That's a hooah to you and me. Ben, your highlight for the week, please.
Well, my highlight was getting some respite to the spending review, which I found slightly taxing, excuse the pun. So I went and got myself fish and chips in the sunshine by the River Derwent in Stamford Bridge, and it was delightful.
Lovely. And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your heart of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. Hi, everyone. I'm always a big fan of when there's like a good sort of bit of argy-bargy in Parliament, and there was a really good example this week up in Scotland where in the Education Committee, the chair, Douglas Ross, was zooming into the meeting from the Caribbean. I believe he was in the Turks and Caicos. It was 3 a.m. in the morning there, and everyone was furious about it. And yet it's the kind of thing, like sort of nice petty squabble that really just livens up following the parliamentary news.
Unbelievable. Right, so we start the week with the spending review. Michael, walk us through it, please.
Yeah, so the big day has been and gone. It wasn't actually such a big day in the end for the higher education sector for two reasons, I'd say. One was that the government has pushed back the announcement of the industrial strategy in its grid it's going to be in a fortnight. And, you know, that's quite an important moment when that materializes. And the other reason was because quite a few different R&D funding announcements were actually made in advance. They came first over the weekend. There was a few more things on Monday and Tuesday. You know, so for the actual day itself, you know, the Rachel Reeves speech and then the sort of publication of lots of documents by the Treasury afterwards, there wasn't loads of new stuff for the sector. You know, but I think the R&D things, in sum, if we look at everything that's come out, there's some quite big consequential things there. In the Sunday papers, we saw that the four-year budget for R&D capital spending is going to be £86 billion, which, you know, is obviously is one of these figures that's like, you know, hard to even conceptualize. But, you know, in sort of simple terms, that's going to be a gradual uptick over the next 4 years of the total R&D the government's funding. You know, whether in real terms it's an increase depends a bit on inflation. And, you know, that includes all the sort of defense R&D and spending by the Department for Business and the Department for Health. You know, it will still be a little while before we know exactly what UKRI's budget is. Or, you know, how much what the government calls core research funding there is. But there were other interesting things there in that, you know, so some of this money is going to go to what, is sort of local innovation funding to be spent by mayors or to be spent locally. There's another £500 million for mission-related R&D. ARIA, that's the Advanced Research Invention Agency, the sort of experimental research funder, got £1 billion over the 5 years, which is a slight increase to its last budget. The University of Edinburgh got its supercomputer back, finally. There'll be more sort of technology-related research funding announced with the industrial strategy. So there was quite a lot of interesting stuff there. There were scholarships, I should say, as well, for sort of especially in AI areas. So I think overall that side of things was a bit of a relief for the sector. In education, we didn't really get anything at all. There were sort of rumours that we might get a tuition fee announcement at some point once the dust settled. They'd also promised announcements on the lifelong learning entitlement. But any of these things, you know, could emerge relatively soon, especially with the LLE. So I don't want to just say, oh, you know, they've forgotten about it or try to read in too much to the fact that wasn't in the Rachel Reeves speech. But yeah, there's still a lot of stuff that the sector's waiting for answers on.
Steph, I'll start with you. I mean, the absence of things can sometimes be a good thing, can't it? I mean, I guess there wasn't any more unexpected bad news in the spending review. So on that level, that's good for the sector, but there's a lot more to come, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the first thing to say is that I think kind of given where things could have been, the kind of settlements both for the DfE and DSIT are really kind of great in the kind of wider context. And I guess you just have to look at other government departments where there have been cuts to see that it could have been a lot worse. As Michael's already said, some of the specific R&D announcements are also really interesting. You know, I was personally kind of particularly pleased to see the Local Innovation Partnerships Fund and that it included money not just for the kind of 7 mayoral combined authorities that are named, but a pot of funding that will be open across the whole of the UK, because I think that's really important. The language in there about Horizon and FPP10 is also, I think, really, really encouraging. As you said, there was kind of a lot less of note on the education side, although I think it probably is useful to reflect that there was an announcement about 1.2 billion for apprenticeship and skills. And my take on that is that most of that money will be going to the kind of 16 to 19 year old demographic because of the kind of demographic pressures, the number of 16 to 19 year olds that they're going to be over the course of this spending review. But nonetheless, having that extra funding in there does mean that we're likely to see less pressure, although there still will be pressure on the kind of higher education budget within the DfE. As Michael's already said, you know, no announcement on tuition fees and maintenance loan linking isn't a surprise within the spending review. And that's something that we're still kind of is all to play for and we're fighting hard for. I don't have any insight on timing other than to say I know that the DfE know that November was too late last year and that we need an announcement before that. And from a kind of UK perspective, the thing that we're also keeping an eye on now is obviously the kind of allocations that follow. Particularly, we're really keen to make sure that UKRI sees that real terms kind of increase in its budget and that within that, the kind of degradation that's happened to QR over the last few years is reversed.
What do we make of this supercomputer business, Michael? Because everyone thought that was cancelled and then it kind of came back again. Is this a kind of triumph of lobbying?
It doesn't feel like a triumph of anything really, but I think it's, you know, it's good news for the university finally. So this was something that was announced with a similar but maybe not exactly the same budget back in the sort of dying days of the Conservatives, and then when Labour came to power, it sort of filtered out the news that they'd cancelled it and they sort of said it wasn't funded. And it's about the only science related issue that ever gets talked about in the Commons. You know, every week the Conservatives would be sort of asking Peter Kyle, why did you cancel it? And he'd say, oh, there was a black hole in the public finances. And they finally sort of, you know, we want to fund it, but you know, we need to make sure it's all costed. And so that's I think it's been sort of felt, it's been kind of understood for a while that money was likely to come back. You know, it's of a piece with lots of the sort of AI related spending announcements, which I sort of glossed over very quickly. But, you know, there were, you know, quite a lot of things like undergraduate and postgraduate scholarships in AI related areas, funding for doctoral researchers who are doing stuff around tech. You know, the government says in the spending review that they've essentially accepted all of the recommendations of the AI opportunities plan that came out earlier this year. So I think for all those things where universities are sort of, you know, showing their value to the government's, you know, aspirations to do big things with AI, has been quite a good set of announcements that have just sort of filtered out each day this week.
Yeah, Ben, there's obviously, as Steph and Michael said, there's lots to come, isn't there, in terms of tuition fees, maintenance, and possibly more kind of wider HE reform. Where do you see this? Like, where do you see this evolving? I mean, the sector was obviously really pleased with the previous linking of fees to inflation, but obviously that didn't really touch the sides when it comes to the sector's losses from declining value of tuition fees in the last decade or so. What do you think we can expect though? What do you think we can reasonably ask for when it comes to that? And also on the maintenance piece, And as these decisions start to kind of come to a head in the next couple of months?
Yeah, and I mean, I think they've pushed themselves into a corner a little, and that the levers that are left for them to pull in order to address a sector that they do value. I don't doubt that they value it for the contribution it makes to the economy and to jobs and to public servants and so on and so on. So, you know, if we accept that they value it and that it needs funding somehow, they have chosen in this spending review not to allocate any significant new funding to it. And so it does put greater emphasis on them to make what will be difficult decisions for them, I suspect, about increasing the fee, because the money has to come from somewhere, or about coming up with something perhaps more radical than we might have assumed in the HE reform proposals. And the levers at their disposal to address a sector that's creaking at the system is growing. And you know, they can't bank on productivity improvements delivering the results they need. There is only so much you can get rid of the labs and still teach the scientists. There is only so much you can get rid of lectures and still teach people. You know, so the fat, if there was any on the system, is disappearing quickly. And actually, government is going to have to make some difficult decisions using new levers, I think.
Michael, this question of lifelong learning entitlement, the LLE, we were expecting something, weren't we, in the spending review, but didn't come. But I know we talked about this quite a bit on the podcast, but can you just sort of bring us up to date with where we are on that and what it is that we need now, or what the sector was expecting to kind of help make this work from a kind of spending point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fairly good chance that something's going to arrive quite soon. I mean, whether it needs to come exactly on the day of the spending review, I think, I don't know, people seem to have a sort of masochistic desire for the government just to publish every single policy alongside the spending review document.
But it felt like it was taken out, didn't it? Because there was even a moment in the Commons when Rachel Reeves seemed to kind of refer to it, but it didn't, you know, we didn't get any...
She made a dreadful joke and delivered very poorly, sort of at Kemi Badenoch's expense. It's about how, you know, lifelong learning is important, referring to something that Kemi had said in some interview that I wasn't even aware of. And it felt like maybe they were going to say something, but perhaps not. It may have just been, you know, some poor job by the script writers. But, what we're waiting for. So the LLE is, in theory, is opening to applications from September 2026 for courses in January 2027. So that's basically a year away. You know, it kind of needs to be ready in a year's time if people are going to be applying in September. And there's loads left to be done. We don't really have, you know, the Office for Students, for example, consulted on how they're going to regulate LLE sort of modular courses. A long time ago, they opened and closed the consultation, and we've heard no sort of response there and no plan for how the regulation side of things will work. There's still lots of questions about maintenance. They need to lay regulations in Parliament for other aspects of it. So there's kind of loads to be done. I mean, I think some people sort of think another delay is on the cards again. It's sort of hard to know because there's been a long time where we haven't had any announcements. So there has been plenty of time for them to do lots of policy work. You would just think, you know, more of it would be filtering out. But I am mindful that they could be sort of publishing a big update to the LLE policy paper even as we speak, or, you know, it could come early next week. There's loads to do. I think we shouldn't yet read anything into the fact that it didn't come alongside the spending review. And I should just add, at the budget last year, they said more information on the LLE will come alongside the spending review, which is why I failed to mention that before. But that's the reason why the sector was sort of on the lookout for new.
But alongside could mean, you know, say today, tomorrow, next week, next month. Yeah,
you know, and I think I don't know exactly why we'd expect big developments in advance of the education and skills white paper. In a way, that doesn't really make any sense, because, you know, the LLE speaks so strongly to what the post 16 education and skills landscape will look like that you can't really do one in a massively substantive way without doing the other.
I guess just to agree with that, I mean, my sense is that there's a level of detail that was kind of missing in yesterday's announcement, both on the R&D and the education side, because of the delayed publication of two things, you know, both of which actually Michael has already mentioned. But the industrial strategy didn't come out yesterday. It will hopefully come out in a few weeks' time, and I hope that we'll see kind of more detail of some of that R&D spend there, and then the post-16 skills white paper. When that comes, I hope that there'll be more detail both on the LLE, but also the kind of broader skills landscape and how this government intends to fund it.
I guess in a similar way to which universities are trying to grapple with growing costs and increased taxation, our students are as well. And, you know, students and young people weren't great winners in the spending review either. So in an environment where, you know, perhaps a good decision was made to soften the approach to withdrawing winter fuel allowances and looking after our pensioners, there were no similar offers to students. And so they will really be feeling some of the pain of this themselves.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Emma Furkle.
And I'm Camilla Suleymanova. And our blog post looks at the identity crisis of pedagogical innovation.
Our research on pedagogical innovation in the post-pandemic university found that the decision to engage with or resist innovation isn't just about workload, resources, or even institutional strategy. It's about identity, who academics see themselves as, and what risks they perceive in stepping beyond the status quo.
During the pandemic, we saw that universities can innovate quickly and effectively. Will these lessons be learned to support academics who are already navigating an identity crisis caught between structural constraints, career incentives, and their own motivations? Universities must decide whether they can move beyond rhetoric and make changes a reality.
Now, the Post 18 Project is back with our first report. And it's all about a new economic mission for higher education. Ben, tell us your impression of it.
The Post 18 Project has dropped its first major report titled Tooling Up, Building a New Economic Mission for Higher Education. And it's calling for really quite radical shifts in policy making in order to move higher education more closely to industrial strategy priorities and regional economic growth. Pushing again the idea of devolution, which we know is increasingly important for the government, and we think it's going to be important for us as well.
Okay. Steph, one of the reasons we put this report out this week was to help the government think about universities and where higher education exists and how it can align better with industrial strategy. But it's also partly to help the conversation in the sector itself about how different types of providers can align better with each other, with regional economies. I mean, I know you might have a kind of corporate view about this from UK, but also it's really interesting your personal take on this in terms of you know, how receptive do you think universities are to that conversation and hearing that kind of message?
I mean, I think they're really receptive to, one, hearing that message, but also, secondly, to thinking about what they can do to provide what this country needs. And that's kind of both a corporate and a personal view. On the report itself, you know, I read it with great interest. It's a really kind of, I think, a welcome contribution to the debate and really timely, given, as we've just discussed, that we're expecting the industrial strategy and then a post-16 skills white paper over the coming months. I also really enjoyed the fact that it was kind of a mixture. I can't exactly remember the words used in the report, but this sense of kind of philosophical underpinning and then some kind of more concrete recommendations and kind of points for reform. And I think that broadly, you know, the kind of five compass points for reform that it sets out are something that personally, you know, I could get behind and universities could get behind. The one that I found a bit more challenging, and I guess some of the philosophical underpinning that I found a bit more challenging, was when we get into that conversation about the tension between competition, collaboration, and student choice. And I think the kind of compass point for reform that talks about cooling the student recruitment market as a way of both dealing with competition in the system, but also trying to support collaboration, feels the most difficult to me. You know, my kind of personal and kind of corporate response to how you should kind of, if you wanted to kind of deal with competition in the system, is to kind of fund, you know, both teaching and research properly to remove some of the the competition there. But I do think it also makes some really helpful and important recommendations and starts to start a conversation around a couple of things that I think is really important that we and universities dig into over the next couple of years. And the one that I wanted to highlight was that it starts to make a connection between the growth and skills levy that this government is developing to replace the apprenticeship levy and the lifelong learning entitlement as well. And I think there's real opportunity within that to develop it, thinking about what that could look like, that kind of dual method of funding higher education in the UK. And I guess from a kind of short-term point of view, I'm really interested in a conversation about whether the growth and skills levy could help support some of that demand for modular provision that will be kind of enabled by the LLE when it comes to fruition. So I think that's really helpful. I also, you know, I think it's really helpful to make sure that universities kind of individually and the sector collectively are thinking about how you kind of kill the academic and vocational divide. There are a lot of lots of great things about Skills England and the recent reports that they've published, including demonstrating the need for higher level skills. But there was one line in their recent report that I think kind of speaks to the fact that that's still something that we need to do. And it said something along the lines of, employers really value degree level apprenticeships at level six because they're a great alternative to higher education. And at that point, I just wanted to kind of throw my laptop out of the window and kind of scream slightly that they are higher education. They're not an alternative to higher education. And they're quite often delivered in universities as well. So I think there's a lot of great stuff in here, and I think there's real appetite in the sector to talk about some of these ideas and to really think about how it can make sure that it is delivering both what students need, but also the skills that the UK needs to grow as well.
Can I just add a comment? I totally agree with Steph about the kind of interesting philosophical proposition that's put across in the paper. I think too long the higher education sector has tried to talk about the value it brings, the public impact it brings, using a fairly narrow set of metrics about the £265 billion we generate for the UK economy, or about the 400,000 people we employ, or there's all these kind of traditional public good metrics we use to show the value of HE, and this is why you should invest. And here we've got something that's saying maybe there are some slightly different ways of aligning and demonstrating your public impact, your good, the way that you support public services locally and nationally, that might help leverage some of that financial support that perhaps we feel has been a bit lacking otherwise.
Some of this isn't, most of this isn't new for universities. And what we're talking about here is how we can help them, incentivize them, push them to be able to kind of do more of the great work that they're already delivering in these kind of skills focused areas. Lots of the universities that I represent are already doing this. It's about making sure that they're able to do more of it and that the demand from students is there to take it up as well.
Yeah, I think just to come back to what Ben said, I think that thing about finding better and slightly more precise ways to evidence, the economic contribution of higher education, it is still important. I mean, this was mentioned in the University's UK blueprint, in this report, in tooling up, it's specifically through a regional lens, talking about what exactly can universities say about their contribution to their region and their local area's economy. I think at the moment, the default is to just sort of go back to some economic analysis that says, this is the gross value added, when, a lot of that is just sort of, international students spending an awful lot of money on rent and sort of these kind of things, which, are not actually necessarily beneficial for the economic growth of an area. They are just a sort of big amount of money churning around and maybe not sort of allied with local priorities. I mean, I noticed just this morning, about half an hour ago, the House of Commons Education Committee is announced an inquiry into higher education funding, or a sort of mini inquiry. And one of the things they specifically said they want to hear about is how do higher education institutions contribute to growth in their local economy? So, that clearly is a sort of, a question that Labour is interested in. And you'd hope also, in terms of the sort of MPs that are manning the committee. And I think it is also something the government would like good answers on.
You know, my in-laws live in Lincoln. They feel, you know, I should be a bit cautious speaking for them, but they talk about feeling very detached from London and from government. But they also talk about how they've seen Lincoln as a city radically change as the university has bought, they wouldn't quantify it in pounds and pence. It's made this much for, you know, it's bought this much money into the local economy. They'd quantify it by talking about the amount of restaurants that are open on a Wednesday night now that, you know, that when there never used to be any open, the amount of friends they've got whose lives touch the university in different ways, you know, because they work there or they study there or they've gone to the theatre there or whatever it is. That bringing to life that local, that really, really local story of the benefit of higher education that's closely aligned and intertwined with the city is really powerful.
As Steph mentioned, that the proposals on cooling the market were challenging and meant to be challenging. How did you see them, Michael?
Yeah, so, I mean, the paper says, you know, temporary but binding limits on growth rates, and this is for recruitment of home undergraduate students, and, you know, to include closer oversight of franchising growth as well. So it's, you know, it's not quite a sort of a blunt instrument to saying, you know, student number controls, but, you know, it essentially, you know, limits on growth rates is a form of managing student numbers, which, you know, in my experience, and somewhat coming a bit late to the debates that have sort of raged over this since they were removed, you know, people can be quite precious about, you know, from my point of view, it's always a bit of a comparison with, okay, home students, you know, it's a threat to university's autonomy, it's a cap on aspiration and all that kind of thing. But with international students, you know, recruitment is in practice capped by universities' CAS allowances. You know, they have to apply for permission to UKVI if they want to issue more student visas. And in the past, UKVI has been very permissive with this, and it's essentially just, you know, you want another 5,000 international students? Yeah, no problem. But in the last year or more, and certainly the direction of travel for the future is this is going to get much more difficult. The immigration white paper said that universities that want an expansion to their CAS allowance, the number of student visas, will need to, in making the case to government and to the Home Office, will need to consider the local impact. They didn't sort of explicitly say housing, but it's thought that is, you know, one of the main things. So, you know, given that lens, it's not unthinkable that the Labour government would see something similar, you know, as important from the sort of local area point of view. Whether they buy into that as a sort of means of promoting collaboration and cooling competition, I think we've had little indication yet whether that's sort of on their agenda. But yeah, it could be. I mean, one of the things I do worry about is, you know, is the current shape of the sector in terms of undergraduate recruitment, in terms of what we saw last UCAS cycle, where there were some quite big changes, is that actually the right shape to, you know, or do we, you know, in theory, where we are now is probably not exactly where you'd like to be. But yeah, definitely a discussion that keeps coming up, but I think still needs to be had.
It feels like it would be hard for the current government to simultaneously talk about being motivated by driving opportunity at the same time as then creating number controls, though, surely.
Yeah, but the proposals just to in terms of cooling the market, is to stop uncontrolled growth in different providers. It's not to control the overall amount of numbers. We want the overall amount of numbers to grow.
The thing that I mean, Michael's already described, I think, you know, what the kind of UK corporate view on this would be, so I'm not going to do that. The thing I find personally challenging about the proposal in this paper, but also I guess the debate more broadly, is that I find it difficult to support anything that would limit student choice in a funding model, particularly in England, where the kind of burden of paying for that is on the individual and has been passed over to the individual in the way that it has now. You know, the kind of percentage at the moment in England, I think, is something around kind of, you know, 84% in kind of totality. And so I suspect this will come. I know this is a kind of project, this is not a one-off report, but I think we also need to think about whether it is the right thing to introduce anything that limits student choice when you are asking the student to pay for the education that they are receiving.
I think that was a better articulation of my point, that the narrative, and again, I said earlier on, I didn't think students had been cut a lot of slack in recent years in terms of investment into them and creation of new opportunities. This is a government that's talking about creating pathways and opportunities for society widely. The narrative of then saying, but I'm going to control it in order to try and deliver growth. That's about them making the critical decisions about what the opportunities are and who should get them.
Well, that's a debate that's going to run and run. Now, James Coe from Wookiees here to tell us all about what's going on with the ref.
Hello, I'm actually the other Jim at Wonkey. I won't explain why, but I will explain what has dropped from Research England. The latest guidance for Ref 2029 is probably the biggest shake-up in how university research is assessed, basically, ever. In simple terms, what's going on is Ref is no longer going to measure individual researchers. It's going to measure institutions. That will fundamentally change how universities think about hiring, how academics plan their career, and ultimately, how research gets funded. If you're unfamiliar, REF, the Research Excellence Framework, is how the UK government decides which universities get how much research funding. Every few years, universities submit their best research outputs, panels of experts rate them. The better you do, the more funding you get. Previously, though, if you were a star researcher who moved from, Manchester to Oxford, your brilliant research paper would count for Oxford in the REF as long as you were there on the magical census date. And that created what critics called a kind of transfer market for academics. Universities would literally poach researchers just before REF submissions to capture their outputs. Basically, I'm told, I don't really understand football, but I'm told this is like Premier League football, but with professors instead of strikers. And what REF 2029 is going to do is change all of that. Under the new rules, there will be no link between individual staff and their outputs. Instead, research will belong to the institution where it was created, where a university provided the lab or the funding or the support or the environment. They're calling this a substantive link, which basically means if you work somewhere for at least a year at 0.2 FTE or more, that's where your research will count. The head of REF policy puts it quite well. He says REF 2029 shifts focus away from the individual and kind of towards the environment where the output was created. And they're using a football analogy. Jude Bellingham might be the star player, but he performs differently for Real Madrid than for England. Why? Because it's the team and the system and the environment that matters. If you're an academic, of course, this could be huge for your career. The days of being headhunted just for your referable outputs may well be all over. Universities are going to have to think differently about recruitment, no longer about buying in excellence at the last minute, but about building environments where excellent research can flourish over time. For smaller universities, this could be a game changer. It's smaller universities that often see their best researchers poached by bigger institutions with deeper pockets. Now, if they've nurtured that research, they keep the credit for that research. But, and you know, there's always a but, this obviously isn't without controversy. Some argue that it's the portability of outputs that is crucial for academic career progression. If you can't take your research achievements with you, how do you demonstrate your value to a new employer? There's also this kind of slightly awkward scenario where a university might submit research from someone they've made redundant. Your research is excellent, but you're fired is not a great look. And the guidance does address this. Outputs can't be submitted if the researcher was made compulsorily redundant before publication. But still, some people will not be happy. Really, though, it's the philosophical shift that is big here. REF is essentially saying that research isn't just the product of brilliant individuals, it's the product of institutions and teams and environments and cultures. And it recognises that behind every published paper are a bunch of technicians and administrators, colleagues and students and all sorts of people who give feedback and help and contribute, and institutions that provided the space and support for that work to happen. With the REF 2029 submission window closing in just 30 months, universities will need to start adapting quite fast. This isn't just about spreadsheets and submissions. It's about fundamentally rethinking how we value and support research in UK universities.
Now, the Student Academic Experience Survey is out this week. Steph, walk us through the highlights, please.
Yes. So this is the annual release that we get from HEPI and Advance AG. And as you probably know, it's a large survey of around 10,000 full-time undergraduate students. And the really great thing about this survey is that it's annual. So you can look at longitudinal trends and see how things are moving and developing over time. One of the kind of starkest differences, one of the key differences in this year's survey year on year was the rise in the proportion of students working during term time. So this year, that's at 68%, up from 56% last year. And from a longitudinal perspective, is also significantly higher than where that stat had sat previously for much of the previous decade at 40%. I think the other thing to note is that this survey often gets a lot of attention because it asks students about value for money. And that question this year saw a slight downtick in those saying that their course was good or very good value for money. And when they were probed a bit further about that, it was clear that when they were answering that question, they were thinking both about the cost of living, but also tuition fee levels.
Unfortunately, I think it's inevitable that students are going to feel they're getting less value for money, because in the same way that if they went and did a weekly shop at Morrison's with £50, they could buy less for it now than they could 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Unfortunately, the same is true for universities. And I have this slight nervousness that the kind of value for money question is sometimes used as a bit of a stick to beat universities with about why they aren't delivering more teaching hours, or why they aren't giving out more generous grants and bursaries, or you know, reducing the price of the housing or whatever it might be. But the reality is, if we are putting less, if we are putting the same amount of money in today that we were putting in years ago, then you know, it's going to feel like it's a lot less value for money to the student.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. Like, you know, so many things that are driving the poor experience reported by some students, you know, a sizable chunk of students are, you know, they do just seem to be increasingly outside of universities' gifts. You know, especially when they're saying that, you know, the amount of disposable income they had available was one of the reasons, you know, that they're surprised that they had less money to spend than they thought they would, is a reason why they think, you know, their course wasn't good value for money. You know, I think the sector will look at these kind of responses and think, you know, there's sort of nothing we can do with that. We are lobbying government hard on things like, you know, upticks to maintenance loans, reintroduction of maintenance grants. You know, it's almost a bit of a kind of dangerous situation, because you can get a bit inured to some of the issues with the student experience, which universities potentially could control, just because, you know, you see the headline things and you see the lack of government help, and sort of be a bit like, or, you know, almost dismissive of the findings, that it's just, you know, well, of course students are struggling when they're, you know, given so little in the way of maintenance support, and the cost of living and rent are so expensive, and successive governments have just, you know, done very little aside from sort of warm words. You know, so it's a bit of a danger to the sector. I think you look at this and you sort of become a bit numb to it. I mean, I think probably what people should be doing is focusing on the things that are in their control a bit more. It's kind of quite interesting to see stuff around teaching, and especially around assessment, holding up quite well. I mean, you know, the thing about sort of timeliness of feedback has really improved, which, I mean, I'm kind of shocked by. I don't quite know how institutions are sort of managing this, but it sort of shows, you know, I guess that there are some things that universities can still really do great work on and that do matter a lot to students. But yeah, it is depressing. And Jim has done a really good job on the site of looking at even the sort of qualitative comments where, you know, students are asked what would make their experience better. And they say things like smaller class sizes, one-to-one interaction with staff, enhanced mental health support. I mean, international students say they would like reduced fees that would make their experience better. You know, all stuff that I think, you know, I think many of us working in and around the sector just see as, you know, these things are just not on the table for the coming few years.
Just back on the maintenance funding point, Michael, you mentioned, you know, uplift, kind of inflationary uplift to maintenance loans and kind of reintroduction of maintenance grants. I think the other thing that I would like to see us talking more about, and I include UK in that, is maintenance loan thresholds and the fact that they have been static over a long period of time, and focus on trying to move those as well. I know that NUS keeps bringing it up, and I think they're really right to, because it's a really important point in some of the underlying kind of funding causes that are driving the cost of living concerns for students.
Mm. And that links to one of the other findings in the report, Ben, was about students in work and actually more and more struggling to get the hours they need, possibly due to the collapse in leisure and hospitality industries.
Possibly. I mean, I thought the stats on those in, you know, working alongside study were quite interesting, and I'm not entirely sure what motivates the actual data. In other words, it might be that there are that people aren't struggling to find the work or to you know, accommodate it within their schedule, just that they're trying to find a comfortable balance where I'm going to earn just about enough to help me out and to perhaps gain some different skills and enrich my CV in a different way. But no, I don't want to do more than however many hours it is a week. One stat that really did jump out at me was that 74% of students who commute 10 miles or more per day are also in paid employment alongside their study. I mean, to commute 10 miles or more a day, then do your study and then do however many hours work, it is really going to be quite demanding for somebody. And that's an example where I'd be saying you wouldn't want that student to be doing, 25 hours paid employment alongside the commute and their study.
You know, because you would hope that this kind of big chunky survey that's asking a massive variety of questions actually shapes policy, right? You would really hope that. I think one thing, if we're talking about sort of, you know, making, you know, increasing flexibility, bringing in the LLE, sort of making paths between HE and FE, I think, you know, it's important for policymakers and, you know, and for providers to reflect on this question about regret. Those doing level 4 or level 5 qualifications as standalone have quite high levels of saying they wish they had done something else. Whether in some cases that would have been, you know, just go straight into work or to do a full degree. But I think it does a good job, this survey, of highlighting, you know, areas which maybe sound like a sort of panacea, but you know, where there's actually still a lot of thought and a lot of policy work needed.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Steph, Ben, and Michael, who also makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.